Already hospital facilities have begun to crack under the strain.
Major cities in all parts of the country, New York, Los Angeles, report plague victims falling dead in the streets, in their homes, at their work.
Colorado Channel, this is a class one emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways. Stay in your homes. Stay in your homes. Those found without specific military orders are subject to summary execution. Stay in your homes. Repeat, Colorado Channel, this is a class one emergency. All civilian traffic is barred from streets and highways.
Hello and welcome. This is John Seven. And on today's show, I will be speaking with Sherry Osden-Nault. Sherry is an artist and activist in Canada. They're of mixed Métis and European descent and a very active member of the Indigenous Two-Spirit community. The challenge for Sherry as the pandemic loomed was to first understand how serious it all actually was. And once they did that, the challenge became to find a way to continue their activism and their creative work within the parameters that the pandemic had laid out. It's kind of a story about your ability to do these things in the first place turning out to be the mechanisms for growth and survival in crisis. I'll let Sherry start at the beginning.
Yeah, it was almost kind of embarrassing how I sort of realized the seriousness of the pandemic. One of my coworkers at the bar that I normally work at sort of as my day job, even though obviously that happens at night, was really like on top of the upcoming seriousness of the pandemic. Whereas I believed the things that we were being told by the government, like last December, that it was just going to be like a flu and everyone would be fine. And at a sort of late staff Christmas party in February, we were all having wine and dinner and drinking and talking. And I kind of made an ass out of myself because I was like, I don't know. They said it's just like the flu. I get the flu shot and I got sick in January. And like, I made out with seven people at the Beaver in early January. I've probably already had it. We're probably fine. And then my boss, the owner of the bar, and my coworker, Lucas, who's like the only person I know who knew how serious it was going to be ahead of time, just kind of stared at me like I had a third head. And then like within a week, I was sending them both a message to apologize for how foolish and obnoxious I had been. Because, yeah, that was when everything really did start getting serious. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, those early days, a lot of it was between the medical world not quite knowing exactly what was going on. And then the government not quite knowing. And then also just them trying to downplay things. So I guess so people wouldn't freak out or whatever. And then the media not knowing, and then word mouth to mouth just from people. I wouldn't blame you for that early on thinking all that. It's not surprising.
I definitely felt very like humbled though when how obnoxious I had been in that conversation when a little wine drunk was like revealed by what was really happening.
Well, they forgave you, I assume. Yes.
Yeah, everybody still likes me, I think, so we're doing okay.
That's good. That's good. But yeah, so given the unknown, were you up to, when you did figure it out, how up to speed were you then? How fast was that for you, like understanding exactly the deal?
I think that happened pretty quickly. Like, one of my friends is part owner of a bar and I'm like pretty close with all the staff there. And then the bar that I was working at was like a very small kind of staff, and bars were one of the first businesses that was like very strongly affected by restrictions here in Ontario. So, I remember kind of like walking around outside and masks weren't a thing yet, but keeping my distance from people, and sort of seeing somewhere in like a group chat or something that it sounded like bar restrictions were going to happen. And like the night that those were said that they were going to be applied, like by the next morning or whatever, kind of having a last drink at a bar with two of my closest friends, and being like, all right, who knows what we're in for? But kind of just the second all the seriousness started hitting, one, realizing my coworker had had amazing insight, and anticipating at least 3 months of kind of chaos, which wound up obviously being an underestimation. But, you know, at the time it was a way longer estimation than anyone in here had. And yeah, just kind of settling in for the ride with that last, like, all right, let's give a bar we like our money, because who knows when we can do that again.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So did you have any immediate realizations about, like, how things might change for you that year? Any, you know, things you were looking towards that you would, at that point, kind of knew wasn't going to happen or wasn't going to be the same?
I don't think I really could have fathomed how different everything would be. Like, it made me think a lot about how for at least the past 5 years, my grandma has been like, you really need to slow down. You need to slow down in your life. And I'm like, have you seen life lately? I don't have time. And so, yeah, I don't think I had any conception of what it would be like to be at home so much, to be mostly unemployed, to be like having to find ways to fill my time. I'm not someone who really enjoys TV very much, so I do a lot of activities because there's like nothing else to do if you don't really watch TV. And so people are often kind of like, oh my God, you're so productive. And I'm like, I don't know, I just need to do something.
So the first days, what did you, as you were, I assume you were just biding time just to see how it all unfolded. But once you realized that you were there at home for a while, I assume you filled your time much the same way you did before?
Kind of. I had like the opportunity to enjoy sort of time to pursue things that interest me in a really different way than I had before. Or like small things changed. Like I started sitting on a blanket on the lawn of the house that I rent in every day. And then I got to know my neighbors and like we'd just sit outside at a distance and chat. And so I had like a harness for my cat, and me and my cat just like sat on the front lawn every day, and I'd bring a book or whatever. And that's, I hadn't even felt like the lawn was space I could use as mine in this shared rental prior to that. So then the change of priorities kind of gave me a reason to take up that space.
That's interesting. So it redefined space for you, and it also redefined, I don't know, acquaintance circles.
Yeah.
People you knew. Yeah.
It was really cool to get to kind of meet the neighbors. I had no idea. The house I rent in is next to a house for people who are in recovery from addictions. And like, they're all really like sweet, amazing folks. And I mean, I think people who are recovering from addiction, like, are working so actively on like who they want to be in the world that it was just great to get to know them. Yeah.
So is that something, is that kind of stuff been able to continue throughout now? Have you been able to extend it for, you know, almost a year, this interaction?
Mostly up until it started getting colder out. When I've kind of run into them here and there now, it's like, oh, I feel like I saw you almost every day. Now I never see you, sort of thing. I have an ongoing friendship with one person who I deal with like some mental health struggles, and they were at the time being diagnosed with like very similar stuff to what I deal with. And so we kind of bonded over that, and I was able to be like, this is a bit of how I deal with that. Because of course, despite like sitting on the lawn being beautiful, there was, I think, a lot of emotional and psychological turmoil for people dealing with these changes in like the pacing of our life. Being stuck at home all the time, while it has had benefits as I've adjusted to it, was like overwhelming and claustrophobic feeling at first, which gave me a great reason to sit on the lawn constantly.
Right. So this is all a positive, I think. And I'm finding as I talk to people, they do come upon positives in this experience. And I wonder if did you expect that kind of thing at all? Or did it seem like all a gloomy prospect ahead for you?
I think I felt really optimistic, despite the ways that I was maybe struggling about how, like folks having to consider their actions affecting one another, was brought into kind of extra visibility and seriousness there, as well as, sorry, I think I'm going to cough 1 second. Okay. As well as just the sort of disruption of like the day-to-day grind for capitalism for a bit too. Mm-hmm. Like I was very curious and optimistic about the ways that that might affect a lot of worldviews that people had become really stuck in, because you don't really get the time to reflect on going through the motions when you only have the time to like go through the motions.
Right. Right. Has any of that bore out for you?
I mean, it's been amazing to watch some of the socially progressive movements over the last year. I've been really happy for that. I'm Métis, so I'm Indigenous. And I remember prior to the pandemic, like there were the protests happening in Wet'suwet'en, and that was a really meaningful thing happening this year, or last year. It's 2021 now. And seeing like the Black Lives protests, which were so important, and a lot more protests about kind of Indigenous land rights. And I think there's been a lot of movement in like increase of visibility there that's been really important. And also the development of such like large and widespread mutual aid networks has been really beautiful to see too.
How was during the year your involvement with your community and like the wider activism community affected?
It increased in, I think, a kind of dramatic way, both because I fortunately was more like physically well than I'd been in a few years near the beginning of the pandemic. So I had the ability to take on a bit more than I had in a while. And then once the pandemic kicked in, having sort of more time to devote resources or energy. So I, with what was happening in Wet'suwet'en in January last year, I had started fundraising through pre-orders with some t-shirts that I designed to send money to the land protectors. And that project continued into the pandemic. I think I actually had the t-shirts made and started mailing them out around April or May. And the amount of time and energy that I was able to put into that was, for a small period, like getting t-shirts ready to ship out to people and stuff, a full-time job. And I don't, I had started that before the pandemic, but trying to like manage dealing with it would have been much harder if I was still working and stuff on a regular timeline when I was actually like putting out the kind of fruits of that labor and I guess like holding true to the goods I had promised people for their donations.
So that gave you time in a lot of ways that maybe you wouldn't have even had with the bar job. And interesting. Would you have usually, I imagine, a component of that life for you must have been, you know, being on site and out in the world and doing things, maybe protesting, you know, I don't know. But so this was, I guess the challenge would be that most of your activity shifted to home instead of kind of splitting. Is that the case?
That's definitely a bit the case because of some physical issues that I have. Being at protests where there's a risk of police violence is a heightened risk for me. I had a jaw surgery a few years ago that didn't heal quite right, so the bones haven't actually fully fused. So I like could get a broken jaw very easily, essentially. So I didn't want to risk being at any of the protests that weren't kind of like a larger popularized thing where you knew that a lot of the Toronto community was going to be there, and then there'd be this sort of fence in that it was like probably a bunch of sort of well-off white people who would be there too. So there's definitely not going to be violence, et cetera. So when there was that level of safety, I definitely made sure I was present at those protests. But the fundraiser actually was something that I started as a way to contribute when I felt like I couldn't physically be in all of the places I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that carried through to a few other sort of fundraisers and things over the course of the year. So that became like a largely thematic ongoing situation.
What other types of fundraisers did you do?
So I design these like cute t-shirts. I've only got 3 designs. It's not like a huge business endeavor or anything. But I donated all of the profits from one design for like many months in the entire first run to different land defenders. And that wound up being a couple of $1,000s, which for me felt really cool because I could never have the financial security to give that much on my own. And then when the Black Lives Matter protests started like really taking off in the States following what happened with George Floyd, I believe it was also Pride Month. And so I made a point, and I'm still doing this, to let Black folks know that if they found the price for my products restrictive, they could message me and I would either see if someone who was white or non-Black wanted to donate the cost to cover a t-shirt and it could be sent to them for free. Or if they could pay cost, I had a like code they could put into my website for that. And then I also, for all of that month, because I realized I had sort of made a slightly crippling amount of work for myself with the first fundraising project, donated half of all of my profits to what wound up being directly to a couple of Black trans youth who needed some support. And then I think August, I don't remember having anything in particular really going on, but who knows? My memory of the last year is a little hazy, like many people's. And then in the fall, I started selling raffle tickets for several pairs of handmade earrings, so beaded earrings, which is a craft I had the time to get better at this past year. I don't know if I would have expected people to donate for my earrings a year ago. but the way I set that raffle up was people could donate directly to a bunch of Indigenous land defenders causes that I had set up a link tree for, and just sending me like a bit of the receipt that didn't show any of their personal info was how they would get their raffle tickets. So none of the money was being processed through me, which was good for like security with EI and stuff, because that's not money I'm getting, so I don't want the government to think it is. And then also just for transparency, like no one had to worry about if what I was going to do with the money, because it was going directly to whatever cause they chose. And that wound up being a couple of $1,000s of fundraising too, and then sending folks some earrings, whoever won the raffle. And that was all like a very rewarding process. And then in December, I sort of accidentally started a gift fundraising situation.
Accidentally?
Yeah. I know, it's amazing, right? I should have seen it coming based on the other stuff I'd been doing in the past year. But I made this post that was like, hey, here's 4 gifts I think I'm going to send to queer Indigenous youth. Like, if any allies want to send a bit of money to cover shipping, cool. Other households should do this too. And I was kind of trying to be like, hey, anyone could do what I'm doing and not like make a me-centered project. But what happened was I had this like outpouring of people messaging me wanting to donate to support this project I was doing. And that kind of just blew my mind. And again, because that's money that's like not for me, I got like another friend to kind of manage the finances of it so that that stuff wouldn't be passing through my hands. And because I'm unemployed because of the pandemic, wouldn't affect my ability to get employment insurance, all of those weird considerations.
Right.
But yeah, wound up with, I think, over $1,000 worth of financial support there, and have been allocating that to different creators, especially Indigenous creators, especially small businesses, to gather items for 23 queer Indigenous youth to receive gifts. Because of how the project expanded exponentially beyond my expectations, I hand-printed some cards that were sent to all the youth approximately in time to arrive by Christmas. Not that I don't celebrate Christmas and, you know, all of those people could have been celebrating anything, but the general kind of gift day to try to hit that mark. And the card sort of let everyone know, like, hey, somebody nominated, it's not the best word, but somebody recommended you to receive a gift from this thing. Someone's thinking of you. You're amazing. Sending you lots of love. You're going to receive a gift probably in January. And so where I'm currently at with that now is like across my kitchen from me, I can see boxes of things that are to go in these gift bundles. And I'm waiting for like the last few items to arrive in my mailbox so that I can start assembling them and ship them out. Yeah. It's been kind of wild, like accidental gift project.
Yeah. That's amazing. Do you have any sense of, say how this year has affected, you know, those kids that you're sending presents for, that, that community of kids, because that's certainly not in my experience. So I don't know. And I'd like to know.
Yeah, I don't, I guess, like have the most kind of on the ground experience because of being in Toronto and being at home. But like Indigenous youth in Canada have, unfortunately, like very high rates of suicide, especially people who tend to be living in more isolated places. There's always a lot of strain with that. I know someone in a friend of mine's community in Calgary lost their life to suicide not too long ago. And that was when I was kind of in the earlier part of organizing this project. And I was like, those are the people that I want to be sending like this gesture of love to and resilience because it's been such a hard year for everyone. And then if you think about like the extra challenges that Indigenous youth are having to face in Canada, which is a very aggressively racist toward Indigenous people country. And then also as queer youth and not only dealing with like the societal challenges around that, but because of like the colonial practice of residential schools and stuff, a lot of Native communities are still having to unlearn the sort of like religious standards of being very homophobic and like kind of anti-queer and not having space for that. So there's a lot of intersections of particularly difficult like challenges there that I can only imagine the compounding of the pandemic. And then I think as like racialized people, when you see your community being harmed too, like that really hits close to home. So like there was a death of Chantel Moore, Levi Rodney, some other folks in the past year. And they, like, they were folks in crisis that the police were called to help, and they died. And that kind of news hits really hard, too. So there's so much at once, you know?
Yeah, and I know that, that even in the most typical situations, it's not as if they always have a reliable support system just at hand. So, you know, with just everyday life exacerbated like it is, that can be an escalation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a thing I've learned kind of just through life experience is, you know, like sending someone, you know, is having a hard time, a message like, hey, I care about you, can have real, tangible, like beautiful and even life-saving effects. And that's incredibly important to I don't know, to like offer out there into the world around us when we can.
Right.
And that project wound up being like a full-time job for weeks and I don't know, probably like a month. So again, having that time was really important. And it's not so full-time now because like I said, I'm just waiting for the last few things, but...
Right. So it's, I mean, it's spilled in and you seem to have, like you said, been pretty good at filling your time, but not just, you know, finding stuff to do, but finding stuff to do that had an impact somewhere, places that were already of importance to you prior to this. And now it seems like, I guess there's an end in sight, but there's still plenty of time left where we're all going to have to sort of deal with this. And then what comes next is going to be a transition. So you're still faced with this time and that you'll need to fill, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
But you seem to have momentum.
I think so.
Do you feel like you have... Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely feel for that. The gift project, people are still expressing interest in supporting. So at this point, I'm seeing that as starting to build a set of funds that will be used next year, which may involve like some heavy administrative work to try to get it into a situation where I don't just have to ask a friend to manage my finances, but maybe it's like a tiny registered nonprofit or something so that that money can be held without like being seen as my money by the government. Because it wouldn't be. And I don't know, I hate administrative work, but I'm not the worst at it. So that's like a thing I can potentially spend some of my time dealing with. I also had jokingly said to a friend that I'm like going to make a commitment to myself to take at least a month off from trying to save the world. When this is wrapped up, because it has at times been incredibly exhausting and a lot of work, even though it's rewarding work. So that's, yeah, a commitment I've made to myself, but we'll see if like I'm actually able to stop doing something for that long.
Well, rest is good.
Yeah, and, so they say.
Yeah. And it helps you do things more dynamically after you have it, I found. So... I could recommend it.
I appreciate that point.
So I was also thinking because you had mentioned about the earrings, that you had time to just improve your ability there. Was that the only place you did that? Where you could work at an actual physical thing? And
there are so many places in the past year that I've been able to pursue things that I've always wanted to know or always wanted to do or kind of knew how to do. But, you know, they say you need 1,000 hours of practice into anything to be good at it. And I don't know how I ever would have found the time to invest in these things without the kind of pausing of regular life that the pandemic provided. So yeah, I started making beaded earrings and playing with different patterns quite a lot for that. Many of my friends have received beaded earrings as a gift. My sister told me yesterday she loved the earrings she got for Christmas. So that's great. I'm often kind of like the broke artist family member who is terrible at gift giving because I don't always have the capacity to do it. So it's been really nice to be able to make things that are beautiful to send to people. And I actually made a bunch of earrings and some other artists made earrings too that are one of the items that's going to be in these gift bundles for folks. And... Okay. I learned pine needle basket weaving a few years ago and was able to sort of reteach myself that based on like a half done piece I had and a finished piece and having like the time to go gather appropriate pine needles and work with the materials I still had. And so that was really cool. And it's something that I think in the future I'll be trying to record, possibly with someone's assistant, a video kind of demonstrating and teaching it so that other Indigenous folks can learn as well as if they would like. And that kind of workshopping has been a thing I think is really great that's come out of the pandemic, where just like learning skills is made more accessible.
Yeah, yeah.
And then what else? Oh my God, I did so much urban foraging. And I made apple cider. I brewed apple cider with 50% urban foraged crab apples. Someone was on your lawn stealing your apples. It might have been me. But they were going to waste. You know, I just meant less to rake up later.
They do just fall all over the ground, and the only ones who eat them are the squirrels. So
yeah, I wasn't causing any harm. And then the other half was apples from the grocery store, because based on my research, you need to balance kind of like the tartness and the complexity of crab apples with some more standard sweet apples. But I wound up doing all of this research kind of in a research hole one day and learning about the different subtleties and flavors that could come through really beautifully. And I've always been interested in brewing, and as a bartender kind of interacted with that stuff to a point, but I've never brewed anything on my own. And cider is apparently really easy. So I was like, great, this is a great intro and I can find half the produce I need for free. It turned out really beautifully and I'm really happy with it. It's not like a canned cider at all. It's things I read online compared that more to kind of a soda where it's like flavored and bubbles are added and sweetened. But it has this like mild sort of tart apple flavor with a bit of the complexity of crab apples and like maybe the lightest bit of bubbliness depending on like which bottle it is. But that's been a delight to share with friends here and there as a gift, and I think it'll be something I want to try to continue to do each year now that I have a bit more of an idea what I'm doing.
And would you want to try other types of things?
Maybe eventually, but I know I have the whole setup for apple cider now, so I might just keep like deep delving into how cool I can make that with the different resources at hand. A friend lent me an aging stave, which is like this small piece of barrel wood. It would normally be like in an aging barrel, and you can put that into a bottle, and then in about a month it will age something like a relevant amount of time that thing would be aged if it was in like a whole, I think it's cherry wood that I have, barrel. And so I aged some of the cider with that, and I haven't tried it yet, but that's going to be sort of an exciting tangent that I was able to explore and might explore in the future. Stuff like that's like nerdy alcohol stuff is pretty interesting to me. anything that's like a really involved technical thing, like seed beads, making stuff with those, it's like you could use a microscope for some of that stuff. But anything that you really have to deep dive really grabs my attention well.
See, this it's fascinating to me because, as we've talked, I get this idea of someone who, you know, your experience prior to the pandemic was sort of leading up to your coping during the pandemic, and the way you approached the pandemic has sort of led into how you're going to live after it. So it's kind of this neat, it's not even a circle, it's a double circle, right? We've gone around once and now you're going around again with more knowledge and experience. And I find this fascinating, where for some people it seemed like a disruption, but for you, just from my vantage point, you kind of you know, transitioned in a little more smoothly, maybe unexpectedly so for you.
I think it went pretty okay. I know some folks who found like at least the summer part of the pandemic really amazing, kind of in my age group. Like one of my former coworkers said, it's the first time that I've gotten a summer break, like since I was in school so long ago, blah, blah, blah. And I think that was really amazing for some people to have that kind of freedom from the ongoing grind of work. I am someone who really struggles with like inaction and inactivity though. So yeah, it gave me an opportunity to really pursue a lot of things that I had always hoped I could pursue, but never really had the time to. And I do think it will affect what the future is going to look like for me in many ways. I'm actually moving out of Toronto at the end of the month to stay with a friend in a small Ontario town called Blenheim. And we're going to have like a good amount of space for art stuff there. And it's going to be a lot less stressful until the end of the pandemic to be there and be with her. And that'll be amazing and more affordable because Toronto's not cheap. But also like the kind of slowing down of life in the city that I've experienced through the pandemic is something that I'm excited to perhaps continue with more intentionally. And I think given the community support that I've built up around these sort of fundraising projects, that's definitely going to be something that I'm going to want to keep present in my life and in my future actions, because like, why garner all this support and not keep like reaching out to them and keep building things? That would feel wasteful to me. So I think it'll affect my activities later too, for sure, because I'm like, I don't want to let go of these things now.
And super big thanks to Sherry for taking the time to talk to me and walk me through their year. You should go to check out Sherry's creative work and find out more about their various projects online at sherrynault.com. And I'll spell that for you, sherrinault.com. As always, the music on the show is performed by the Mighty Atom, who just happened to have a new instrumental album out. You can find that at destroythemightyatom.bandcamp.com and buy yourself a copy. And as always, I am John Seven. If you go to johnseven.me, that'll tell you whatever you need to know about me, whatever you didn't need to know about me. Thanks for listening. Please tell me something.